Good evening and welcome to Outsources. I'm your producer, Karen Rayforth, and I'm pleased that a former Outsources Collective member, Dr. Glenda Russell, can join us to interview a very special guest. Glenda is a psychologist, writer, researcher, instructor, and activist who joins us periodically to contribute to our knowledge base on key LGBTQ issues. Glenda?
Thanks, Karen. It's my pleasure to be back for a visit to Outsources. Today, I have the opportunity to speak with Greg Burke. He's the author of Gay, Catholic, and American. Greg is a health economist for an insurance company. He's been involved in two very important LGBTQ movements. One is marriage equality, and the other includes efforts to work against discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America. Greg and his husband, Michael DeLeon, have been activists while rearing two sons, and they have been full participants in their local Roman Catholic parish, Our Lady of Lourdes, in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to Outsources, Greg.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here tonight.
You and your husband are coming to CU Boulder soon. That's going to be on September 27th, right?
That is correct. The 27th at 6 p.m.
We'll talk more about that at the end to make sure people have that information. We'll also put it on our website so that people will be able to check that out and meet you in person. What can people expect from your visit? What will be your focus?
Well, you've mentioned a couple of key points. The thing that people usually want to hear from us when we give a talk like this, they want to hear about our experience as plaintiffs in Obergefell versus Hodges. Of course, I think your listeners probably know already that was the 2015 landmark decision that resulted in marriage equality for the entire country. It was very hard fought. So we'll be talking a lot about our experience as plaintiffs in that particular case. We were the Kentucky lawsuit, Burke versus Beshear, that moved up through the federal court system and got merged with the other three states from the Sixth Circuit. So people love to hear about that. We also like to talk about our experience with the Boy Scouts, and you alluded to that as well. That's a battle that's ongoing, although the policies have changed in the Boy Scouts. They are still far from perfect, and I am still barred from participating as a Scout leader as of today, after 10 years.
It's an interesting thing, though, from reading your book, you may not participate as a Scout leader, but you do everything that a Scout leader does, and then some.
That is correct. Although, you know, I've got to tell you, in my old age, it's like I'm starting to wear down a little bit. So not as much as I used to.
Yeah.
But I would like to be a full Scoutmaster again. You know, it's a matter of principle at this point that, you know, I was forced to resign from my position in the Boy Scouts in 2012. And I have been fighting ever since that point to get back. The Boy Scouts of America have changed their membership policy so that they now allow gay youth members and gay and lesbian adult leaders, except that they allow sponsoring organizations like my parish or my archdiocese to discriminate. And that's what every archdiocese in the country has decided to do. As far as I know, there are no Scout units sponsored by Catholic parishes that have allowed a lesbian or gay leader to register.
And of course, as you say in your book, two of the major sponsors of Boy Scout troops are the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, and Catholic churches. So that covers a lot of territory that does not move with the Boy Scouts,
right?
Sort of tacit statement that anybody can be a leader.
And I probably didn't mention it in the book, but, you know, the Baptist Church, especially in the South, is extremely prominent and sponsor a lot of Scout units. And a lot of those units, after the decision to allow gay Scouts, disbanded. So they left the Scouts completely, and they took up with an alternative organizations. They either formed their own, or there's another group that sprouted up that's kind of a right-wing fundamentalist Christian group, Tri-Life USA, broke off and went with. But, you know, fortunately, Scouting continues. It's not as healthy as it once was, but I still believe it has a great future. And, you know, my kids were Scouts, and I think it's just so important to give our youth those kind of opportunities. It's like, what I don't understand is why people feel so strongly that, you know, a gay person or a lesbian person can't be a leader in one of those units. You know, if you know anything about the Boy Scouts, like, they run extensive background checks on their members. It's like, there's no way you can be a leader in this day and age without being thoroughly vetted. I went through all that process. I know other leaders who also have been barred or were barred. had to go through that same process as well. And it's just sad that it's such a pure case of LGBT discrimination. It's just, it couldn't be any more blatant.
It's such a pure case of a piece of bias that doesn't actually fit the statistics on who's likely to abuse young people.
Right.
So let me get you to back up a little bit. One of the things I was interested in reading your book, Greg, was you're a native of Kentucky. You've lived there most of your life. You say in your book, Gay, Catholic, and American, that a lot of the focus on LGBTQ people in the press has been on people who live on the coasts. Here in Colorado, we call that coastism. What do the media miss when they don't talk with or cover those of us in the so-called flyover states? How's it different being in Kentucky than being in LA or New York?
Well, we have to fight a lot harder for our rights and for acceptance, I think. I think things come a little bit easier on the coast where there is, just a lot more support. But in a place like Kentucky, perhaps a place like Colorado, still there are very rural areas. So we have enclaves in our cities. So in Kentucky, we actually have a couple of fairly large cities that are very progressive. And I happen to live in one of those, fortunately. I can tell you that when you move beyond, the city of Louisville or the city of Lexington and move out into our rural areas, there is a lot of bias against queer people. It's just it's not accepted. That's why there are so few people in our queer people in our rural communities. As soon as they get a chance, they either move to Louisville or Lexington, or they move to Chicago, or they move to Atlanta, the next closest big city. And so that's one of the issues, I think, that a lot of people that live in red states have to deal with, is like, do I stay or do I go? And if I stay, what does that mean for me? What am I going to do about that? And so in my case, my husband and I lived in Connecticut after college for 4 years. So we moved to the progressive Northeast, not because it was progressive, but because that's where the jobs were. And so we worked in Connecticut for 4 years. But after that, we decided to come home to Kentucky because all of our family was here. That was so important to us, to be closer to home. What a monumental shift that was to come back to, because I think I mentioned in my book, I've been out since I was 19. So 47 years I've been out of the closet. And it was so much easier living in the Northeast, to come out to people, to be open. I was openly gay at work in the 1980s in Connecticut. So to move back to an area like Kentucky in the 1980s, we still had sodomy laws on the book. We had no protections in any cities across the state for queer people in terms of housing, employment, or public accommodation. And we didn't have that until 1999. So it's been a very slow, hard slog in Kentucky. In Kentucky, we still don't have statewide protection against discrimination in housing, employment, and public accommodation. So it's piecemeal, it's city by city. And we've got 22 cities now that offer that. But the majority of the Kentucky population doesn't have that protection. So it's really difficult. And I think people that live in states where they have statewide protection don't realize how vulnerable that makes people in states like Kentucky and a lot of the South.
It was one of the things that I noticed, especially in the early part of your book, when you were in different contexts, you would talk about, are we going to come out here? And you'd be sometimes thinking, okay, this will go okay, and it didn't. Or you'd think, this is going to be a mess, and it wouldn't. There was a lot of surprise. Is that what psychologists call the anticipation of rejection? And it's in your head, it occupies a lot of psychic headspace and a lot of energy, and it's not good for people at all. And while we're on that topic, let's talk a little bit about Our Lady of Lourdes Parish in Louisville, where you and Michael have been out for years. You did it a little slowly at the beginning, but you've been full participants in the life of the church. You've been honored by the church with various important tasks. What's that like? What do you say to people who think all the Catholics are against us and they're never going to vote for us?
The American Catholic Church is so diverse. And so I can tell you that in the city of Louisville, we have, I think, about 50 different parishes. And there's tremendous variation from parish to parish. So you can go into a couple of parishes, and I've been in a couple of them where they preach, hellfire and brimstone, very anti-gay. And then you can walk into other parishes that are extremely progressive and accepting. Our parish at Our Lady of Lourdes, we actually formed an LGBTQ ministry with the blessing of our pastor several years ago. So it's an anomaly that you can have, you know, one church supposedly in the Archdiocese of Louisville where there's that much variation in interpretation of the doctrine and you know how it works. But I'll tell you what Michael and I figured out over a course of many years is that you really do change people's hearts and minds just by showing up and being there and participating, and by not necessarily walking in with a banner or a bullhorn, but by showing up and volunteering to work at fish fries, volunteering to work, you know, at different events. You know, we've been involved in a variety of church ministries over the year a lot. And so we're very active, not just in, you know, in parish life, but in the liturgical life of the parish. So it's really kind of funny now that after 35 years in the parish, Michael and I are considered like some of the elders of the parish because we've been there so long. It's truly remarkable. But I think I learned a lot of that from my parents. And like my parents bought their house. They stayed in the same house for 54 years. They were married for 67 years. You know, they were just very stable and rooted. And Michael's family was the same way. So I think we brought that into our life together, just this stability, this longevity. So, you know, if we've been in the same house for 35 years, at the same church for 35 years, you know, Michael retired from GE Appliances after 34 years there. I retired from Humana a couple of years ago after 24 years there. So it's like, you know, that's kind of part of our innate being, I think. That's who we are. It's just been remarkable to see that parish accept us, because as we move through time, you know, we were very, you know, used to be sit in the back row and, you know, try not to draw attention to us. But then we got involved in a lot of ministry. So with the Boy Scouts and then with the marriage equality case, it's like we were on TV and in the newspaper all the time. And I'll tell you, it was just remarkable to see the support that we got from our fellow parishioners. And I would say to a certain extent from the leaders of our church as well. Our pastor, you know, they did as much as they could without getting themselves in trouble. So they were walking kind of a fine line in terms of how much support they could show. And they did the best they could. Yeah. But the people in the pews, they've been with us for decades.
It turns out that the people in the pews in general have been with us for decades more broadly. High proportions of Catholics mean we get better voting. We get better voting outcomes all across the country, despite what the doctrine says and despite what church leaders say. In case you've just tuned in, you're listening to Outsources, a weekly radio show dedicated to queer people and queer stories on KGNU in Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Greg, your book covers a lot of territory around your and Michael's being one of, what was it, 37 plaintiffs in the Obergefell case. That's a lot of plaintiffs. It's a fascinating story. I want to know, what was the hardest part?
The hardest part was getting 37 people together on things, because there were various, the 37 plaintiffs, but then you can't imagine the army of attorneys that were involved. So four states came together with 37 plaintiffs. We in Kentucky had probably had 10 attorneys that we brought with us. The other states, you know, they probably all brought about the same. And then when we got to the point of appealing to the Supreme Court and that was accepted, then the national organizations came swooping in with their attorneys. So then, you know, we had legal help coming in from the ACLU, from HRC, from, you know, you name it, Lambda Legal. It's like they were all coming in and trying to help. It was overwhelming trying to get, you know, it's hard to get 37 people to agree on anything. It's like decisions had to be made about, you know, what we were going to do, when we were going to do it. And so that was a challenge for us to kind of keep everybody together and make decisions. And there were two separate groups. There were two very distinct groups. And, you know, if you remember back to the oral arguments, the Supreme Court specifically asked two different questions, because we had some of us, some of the plaintiffs like Michael and I, who were legally married in other jurisdictions, and we just wanted the Commonwealth of Kentucky to recognize our marriage. But there were other people in a separate group, and the separate question was about a state licensure. They wanted to get married in Kentucky, but Kentucky wouldn't allow them to get married there. And so that was a big rift kind of between our plaintiff group as well, because some of us, we had the same goal in the end, we all did. But, you know, at the end of that case, the decision could have come back that yes, we will recognize legal marriages from other vicinities, but we're not going to force the state of Kentucky to have marriage. Anything could have happened. And so there was a lot of tension, I think, between those two competing groups in our plaintiff groups.
How did you and Michael talk with your sons and prepare them for this? They were adolescents when most of this was going on. That's a complicated situation. How did that work?
Well, when we started, I'm trying to think now. I think our kids were 8th grade and then freshman year. So they were 1 year apart in 2013. And we sat down and talked to them and told them that we were thinking about doing this. So their first reaction was that they were sort of outraged because, like a lot of people of that age, young people, they didn't realize that the state of Kentucky didn't recognize our marriage. They were at our wedding when we got married in 2004 in Canada. They participated in the wedding, and as far as they knew, we were married. I mean, they weren't aware of the nuances of that the state of Kentucky didn't recognize that. We did talk to our children about that, and we explained to them that we were thinking about participating in this lawsuit, but we weren't going to do it, and if they weren't comfortable with it. They were outraged over learning that the state of Kentucky didn't recognize their marriage. And they said yes, that we definitely should pursue that. And after a few weeks, our attorneys came back to us and said, "Would you like to add your children as plaintiffs to the case as well?" And so then we had to have another family meeting and talk to them about that. It's like, "Do you want to do this? We're not going to do it if you don't want to." We explained to them that, it's an important case and they didn't have to do it if they didn't want to, but they were all in. They wanted to do it. They wanted to participate. It was difficult for our children, and you probably, caught some of that in my book, talking about the fact that they both attended Catholic schools. So they went to Catholic school from preschool through high school. So when this case was going on, they were going up through the Catholic school system, which was extremely, it's as divided, they it was as divided then as our country is now. I mean, it was nearly 50-50 in the Catholic schools, people in favor of gay marriage versus opposed it. And so they had to become defenders of the cause because their parents and they were plaintiffs in the case. So it kind of thrust them into a role that I think was a challenge for them at times. But they seemed to rise to the occasion every time they needed to.
Yeah, including one of your sons at the Supreme Court, sort of carried around a rainbow flag and apparently intentionally marched by the people who were demonstrating against marriage equality, as I recall.
That was one of my proudest moments as a parent, to see him do that. So, leading up to, and that was before oral arguments, though, there were weeks and weeks of demonstrations in front of the court. So there were, people in favor of marriage equality. There were a lot of religious groups that were there protesting in opposition. Some of them were very loud. There were some very large groups. They were very confrontational. And so there was one incident in particular where there was the religious group, people with a bullhorn, and they were like screaming at us. And so our son Isaiah borrowed a rainbow flag and just walked over in front of them and defiantly paraded it back and forth. It did kind of surprise them, and they backed off a little bit, but we were really so proud of the way he handled that. If I had done it, it wouldn't have been that effective.
This is an unfortunate question to have to ask, but I have to ask it given the timing. Since the Dobbs decision, the decision about abortion that was before the Supreme Court and that was decided upon, I guess, in June, there's been a lot of talk about could marriage equality disappear? And there are some legally tenable reasons to ask that question. What does that kind of discussion do to you? There was a section in your book where you talked about this has been permanently installed in the United States. And I went, if I had read this 3 months ago, I would have just kept reading. But reading it now, I went, oh my heavens, is it permanently installed? How are you dealing with that?
It's tough. It's very difficult. So since the first day the decision, since June 26th of 2015, when this decision was rendered, we have constantly gotten those questions. Is it over? Is it done? Is it going to go back to the court? Is it going to be overturned? Constantly, And, I have consistently said, no, it's settled. The court has, never overturned a ruling like this in the past, and they hadn't. They never voted to take away rights until they did with Dobbs. So up until a couple of months ago, I never thought that I mean, I would have thought that the percentage that it would happen, would be the odds are like 99.7, against it. Now I'm not so sure, and it concerns me in a state like Kentucky because I see what's already happened. Kentucky had a trigger law for abortion rights that went into effect immediately, as did many other states. And Kentucky is that kind of a state that has such a Republican supermajority everywhere that they can do and will do whatever they want, and they tend to like to pick on easy targets. And they couldn't. They've got others that they've been picking on the trans population in Kentucky for the last few years, passing laws that are very restrictive and hurtful. So if this is a case that if there is a case that comes forward to the Supreme Court and this gets overturned and it gets sent back to the states, I'm telling you, there are a lot of states like Kentucky that we are going to have some serious problems, and I am very, very concerned about it. But like you said, it's like 6 months ago, before the leak happened, I didn't think this was possible. And now we see that anything's possible.
What will that mean for you if it gets overturned? I know what it means legally. Well, I don't know what it means legally, but I can guess given Kentucky's politics as you've just described them. Will you become activists again, or will you can? I know you're still an activist with the Boy Scouts issue. What will you do?
Well, I mean, we'll continue to fight for marriage equality. I think it's important to us. We did it the first time. Look, the odds were against us the first time. And I don't know
Yes.
if you caught that, in the book. It's like when we filed our lawsuit, the whole country just laughed at us, except for the people who got really pissed off at us, who said, you're gonna destroy the movement. You're gonna lose in Kentucky, and it's going to set the movement back 20 years, right? So it's like we took all that back in 2013 when we launched, and we stood up against that, and we continued to make our case. We were rational about it, and we fought and fought, and eventually, we won that good fight. So if it came to that again, we would continue to fight. One thing I will tell you, I'm a Canadian, so I'm not leaving. So whatever the state throws at me, I'm going to deal with it the best I can. But yeah, it could get pretty ugly here in the
Yeah.
future.
Based on what you know, because you've had this experience of going through a couple of major fights where you have stuck your neck out and have taken a lot of grief and have worked very hard and exhausted yourselves over and over and over again. What have you learned about what you need from allies?
Oh my goodness, allies are just so important. And I didn't even talk about in the book the extent to which Michael and I have been involved with organizing workplace groups. So we were both founders, like Michael at General Electric and me at Humana, founders of our LGBT employee groups. Those groups never would have been founded without allies, because if you move into a corporate environment like GE or Humana, it's like it's difficult for minorities to get anything done. But by bringing allies into the efforts, that's where we really gained momentum. It was the same way with marriage equality. One of the interesting things about the Kentucky case is, we had a lot of plaintiffs and we had a lot of attorneys. All of our plaintiffs obviously were queer. All of our attorneys were straight. They were all allies. They were in it because they believed in equality under the law. That's what it was about. So in Kentucky, it's like we don't get there without the allies that were our attorneys. So they're incredibly important, not just in law, but in pretty much all endeavors. It's like we all have to work together to get anything done, right?
Yeah. And so you may be calling upon them again. Well, you will in
Yeah.
any case, but particularly if there's a setback in.
Well, we can't know what the options are to kind of challenge things until we see what happens, right?
That's right.
So like what we're seeing in the states now, it's like every state is attempting to do something different in terms of abortion restrictions. And so I expect that the same thing could possibly happen with marriage. So in Kentucky, we don't know what that would look like until it actually happens. And so we can't plan a response until we see really what we're fighting.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one thing, and it's so important. In Kentucky, at the time we filed our lawsuit, a majority of Kentuckians were in 2013, a majority were still opposed to same-sex marriage. Now it's up to, I think, 66 or 67% of Kentuckians
In
are in
Kentucky, yeah.
favor in Kentucky of the people, not the, don't talk to the politicians, talk to the people, do a study, do a survey, and 67% are in
That's
favor
right.
of same-sex marriage. So it's going to be difficult for the politicians to move forward with things that are really restrictive or really attack marriage equality, because it's so well accepted and approved of, even in Kentucky.
Well, that's certainly a very different entree than it was the last time when you started in 2013, that's for sure.
Right.
Why did you decide to come to Boulder? I mean, I know you got an invitation, but what about the invitation was attractive to you and Michael?
Well, as I said, Michael worked at General Electric for a very long time, and one of his good friends, Melissa Martin, works there. A good friend of his. Turns out that she has a sister who is a professor, Marissa Ehringer, at Boulder there. And the sisters were talking, and they agreed that they thought we should come. And so then Marissa reached out to Michael and me and said, look, we'd be interested in having you come talk about your journey and your experience. And we thought, well, sure, we love doing that. We actually do a lot of this, Michael and I do.
Yeah.
We've been working corporate jobs for the last few years, so it's been difficult. I'm still working. It's just we work things in when we can. For example, we did an appearance in Alaska a couple months ago. We went to visit our son who's in the army there. We're going to Danville, Kentucky. I don't know if you're familiar with Centre College. On Sunday, there's going to be an event there where we're getting all of the Kentucky plaintiffs together for a
Nice.
forum, which is going to be very nice.
Yeah, that's great.
So we do a lot of these events. We try to get out. And then, of course, I don't know if you've published a book or not, but when you do publish a book, there's an expectation by the publisher that you get out there and promote it.
Yep.
So I've been doing a lot of that across the country, visiting in bookstores and talking to groups at different places.
Well, it's interesting because your talk here is being sponsored by the law school, by the Pride Center on campus, and by the community group out in Boulder County. So a lot of people are interested in what you have to say. You've been listening to us on KGNU Radio. I'm Glenda Russell, and I've been talking with Greg Burke, who is an activist and the author of Gay, Catholic, and American. You can hear Greg in person along with his husband Michael on Tuesday, September 27th at 6 p.m. in the Wolf Law Main Courtroom 101 at CU Boulder. Come, and everyone is invited, and it's a free talk, and it should be really fascinating. You've just gotten a flavor of it, and we'll have more time then. Join Outsources every Monday evening at 6:30. It's homegrown queer radio every week, or you can listen to this and other Outsources broadcasts at news.kgnu.org/outsources. Good evening.